we denote it as being highly impacted by El Nino. So in the tropics, the effect of El Nino is actually much more dramatic than what we observe in the United States.
What were you most surprised by in this study?
So we were actually most startled by the magnitude of the effect. The idea that El Nino could affect one-fifth of conflicts around around the world startled us, and it was completely unexpected.
Give an example.
So, you know, we have it's very difficult to pin down a particular conflict as being related to El Nino. In general, I think the way to think about it is that the global climate is a contributing factor to ongoing existing conflicts. But there are many countries in the sample that look particularly conspicuous because they begin conflicts in El Nino years.
Right.
For example, Peru, Sudan, Chad, Indonesia, Myanmar. These are all countries that have experienced conflicts that seem to be highly correlated with this process.
We're going to link to your study at democracynow.org. Solomon Siang is our guest, the lead author of a study linking civil wars with global climate change, postdoctoral student at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Has an immediate opening for an experienced audiovisual archivist. For more, you can go to our website at democracynow.org, write to job at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mata, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, and Alkoff, and Hani Masood. Robbie Karen, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Listen to Family Matters every Sunday morning from 8 to 9 o'clock on CFRU 93.3 FM. Family Matters explores the joys and challenges of family life. On this show, we talk about traditional and non-traditional families, supportive parenting paradigms, relationships and communication, and cultural influences on the family with the help of parents, children, and expert guests. Grab your favorite morning brew and join us for Family Matters every Sunday morning from 8 to 9 o'clock on CFRU 93.3 FM.
You're listening to Terra Informa, a syndicated environmental news program produced at CJSR in Edmonton, Alberta. Stay tuned to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
This is Terra Informa, environmental news from across the country. Hi there, and welcome to the show. My name is David Karchin, and I'll be taking you through the next half hour of environmental news, current affairs, and, well, downright quirky environmental stories. Amongst the highlights this week, we've got a movie review of Gasland, a documentary. We take a look at a strange and deadly family of chemicals called dioxins. And our correspondent Rebecca Rooney looks into a novel method of controlling insect pests with fungus. All that coming up. But first, let's head to the newsroom for this week's top environmental headlines with Ian McKenzie.
We have four environmental news stories to report on this week. The first two relate to Canada's Arctic region and are about melting sea ice and recovering caribou. Our third story is about a researcher at the University of Alberta who's making a plastic material from hazardous cow parts. And our final story is a short review of DFO scientist Christy Miller's appearance this week at the Cohen Commission inquiry into the decline of British Columbia's Fraser River sockeye. Two major Arctic shipping routes have become ice-free this summer. European Space Agency satellites show that both Canada's Northwest Passage and Russia's Northern Sea Route have opened. This year's summer melt is on its way to breaking the 2007 record for the smallest amount of sea ice since the satellite program began in 1979. The news is of interest to shipping companies who could benefit from the new route if it becomes an annual phenomenon. Small craft have already been using the openings in recent years, but as of yet, large commercial ships have largely not. However, this summer, several tankers carrying natural gas were able to use part of the route. The commercial opportunities of an ice-free Arctic passageway have created tension between northern countries such as Canada, Russia, and the United States over national boundaries. The environmental concerns over this stark evidence of global warming include, amongst many things, the long-term survival of polar bears that are specifically adapted to hunting prey on sea ice. The decline in Arctic caribou may have been reversed by hunting restrictions. A herd of over 200 scientists from around the world gathered in Yellowknife this August for the 13th Arctic Ungulate Conference. The theme of the conference was challenges of managing northern ungulates, and one of the main stories coming out of this year's conference was how restrictions on hunting caribou in Canada's Arctic may have helped halt the decline of caribou. Research gives some optimism that restrictions on hunting may be correlated with a leveling in the decline of caribou populations. In 2009, 9 of Canada's 11 northern herds were considered to be in decline. Biologists estimated the Bathurst population on the Central Barrens had fallen to 32,000 from more than 120,000 in 2006. But since then, both the Cape Bathurst and Blue Nose East herds have stabilized. In a paper published in May in the Journal of Wildlife Management, conference attendee Jan Adamczewski, a biologist with the Government of the Northwest Territories, and 3 co-authors suggested that hunting was a potential reason for the accelerated decline of adult caribou. As part of a caribou recovery strategy, hunting restrictions were recommended. Resistance was strong to hunting restrictions from people in the Arctic who rely heavily on the caribou hunt for food. Several Aboriginal groups took the territorial government to court. But in the end, most of the caribou management boards, composed of government and Aboriginal representatives, brought in the restrictions. According to biologists, caribou populations have always fluctuated rapidly, with or without human intervention. Climate change and, to a lesser extent, industrial development is altering the habitat to which caribou have adapted. In the not-too-distant future, parts of your car could be made from a cow. David Bressler, a professor at the University of Alberta's Agricultural Life and Environmental Sciences program, and his research team are figuring out how to take those organs and tissues of the animal that are currently deemed hazardous by the Canada Food Inspection Agency and turning them into a multitude of useful non-hazardous products, including car parts. The research began as a response to the economic decline in the beef industry because of the mad cow disease crisis in the mid-2000s, which deemed certain parts of the cow carcass hazardous and unusable under the requirements of the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. Burying the materials in a landfill would void that land for future farming purposes, and burning the materials has serious environmental concerns. Bressler and his team searched for other alternatives in the form of turning these waste materials into plastic-like components. Excluding the now hazardous parts of the cow ultimately decreased the dollar value of the animal, thus having economic impacts in addition to environmental ones. One goal of Bressler's research is to improve the economic viability of the beef industry by finding new dollar value for previously unusable parts of the animal. Bressler and his team will spend the next year working on creating new recipes for the product to create different levels of durability and biodegradability. He has also started to talk to companies that use plastics in their cars so as to align with the requirements as he tests his products. And now an update on the Cohen Commission inquiry into the decline of salmon. Muzzled DFO scientist unleashed at Cohen Commission. When Dr. Miller, DFO scientist, spoke at the August 25th hearing of the Cohen Commission inquiry into the decline of sockeye salmon in the Fraser River, it was not to link a virus that she'd been studying to salmon farms. Some environmentalists had been foreseeing Dr. Miller's work as key in implicating salmon farms in the decline of sockeye salmon. Dr. Miller explained how her research did not focus on Atlantic salmon or any other salmon from salmon farms and therefore would neither be able to suggest a connection or no connection between the salmon virus she had discovered and salmon farms. However, EcoJustice lawyer Tim Leadham, who represents the Conservation Coalition at the inquiry, introduced into evidence 2 separate emails from DFO colleagues where the colleagues seemed to be deterring Dr. Miller from expanding her research to include farmed Atlantic salmon. At the August 25th hearing, salmon farm representatives agreed to future testing for the new virus at salmon farms. Dr. Miller's research resulted in a paper published in the journal Science this past January. Dr. Miller was prevented from speaking to media about her work by the Harper's Government Privy Council. Dr. Miller told the commission on August 25th that a federal official told her not to speak to the public so she could reserve her comments for the inquiry. To note, the staff of the Cohen Commission have asked all witnesses to reserve talking to media about issues relative to the inquiry until after they have appeared at their scheduled hearing. You have been listening to the Terra Informa Weekly News. Back to you, David.
If you've just tuned in, this is Terra Informa, environmental news broadcast nationally. First up this week, a story about fungus. Fungus and insects, to be exact. Now, you might think that fungus growing on insects sounds pretty strange, and you'd be right. But insects are the preferred host for the parasitic fungus Bruveria bassiana, and scientists have worked out how to use this as a biocontrol agent on insect pests. One of those scientists is Sunil Rajput, a former grad student from the University of Alberta's Department of Biological Sciences. His research focused on a fungus's potential as an alternative to chemical insecticides in pest management for greenhouses. Earlier this year, correspondent Rebecca Rooney asked him about his research findings and filed this science short report.
So I'm here today with Sunil Rajput, who is it alumni or alumnus?
Alumni.
I think alumni at the University of Alberta. And what department did you graduate from? Biological sciences?
Biological sciences, yes.
And your research was in reducing pesticide use by implementing biocontrol measures within greenhouses.
Correct.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. With the concerns centered around chemical or synthetic insecticides being insecticide resistance and the harmful effects on humans and the environment, my research was aimed at looking at alternatives, safer alternatives, that can be used to target these insect pests and have a lesser effect on the environment and, of course, humans.
So what sorts of less dangerous means of targeting these pests were you working with?
I was looking at microbials specifically, and there's different types of microbials. So there's bacteria that can be used, there's viruses that are used, protozoans, nematodes, and fungi. And I focused on fungi because the insect pest that I was looking at is western flower thrips, and western flower thrips are plant fluid-sucking insects. And so fungi have an advantage because they can be topically applied, whereas other microbials such as viruses, bacteria, in order for them to be effective, they need to be ingested. So we chose fungi because they can be topically applied, which is the most common mode of delivery, and it's effective for plant-feeding insect pests.
Like the thrip.
Like thrip. Other examples of insects that feed on plants are aphids, whiteflies, and these are all greenhouse pests.
So what does the fungus do to the insects?
So what the fungus does to the thrips is basically if you spray this as a fungal spores, these are the reproductive propagules, and they basically contact the host surface and they penetrate into the host body and produce toxins and start consuming the host from the inside and then kill the insect and then reemerges from the dead host to disseminate to another host insect.
Ah, so it's self-propagating within the greenhouse system.
Right. And it's selective because the fungi that's being used, not only is it commonly found in the soil and widely distributed worldwide, but it targets only insects.
How does this method relate in terms of efficacy to more traditional pesticides, like chemical pesticides?
Well, when you're comparing a static chemical to a dynamic microbial agent, it's hard to take efficacy one-on-one. So let me explain. When you use a chemical insecticide, a synthetic, when you use this product, it may be more effective at killing the insect. However, you have the buildup towards resistance. You have insecticide residue, depending on how much is applied and at what interval, and then what the active ingredient is in terms of its persistence or chemistry. When you have a biological agent, it may be effective in terms of it does kill the insect, but it may take maybe another day to kill the insect. So it may take some more time, but it is effective at killing the insect over a longer period of time. And that ranges for different biological agents. Now, the advantage is that It's highly selective towards insects. It's self-limiting in the sense of, in some cases, if there's no host available, then some biological agents will stay at a baseline level.
And can the insects become resistant to the fungus?
Well, in our case, the fungus wants to overtake the insect, and the insect wants to protect itself from the invading fungus. So there's an arms race there. So the chances of a resistance are less than a static chemical that doesn't change. If the insect changes, the fungus will also change.
So they'll adapt to one another.
Right, right. I think in terms of addressing the question of efficacy, I try to suggest a more broader perspective.
So how well adopted are these practices within commercial greenhouses?
Over the years, so when I started back in 2001, there was slow adaptation into the greenhouses. However, as the growers become more informed of biological agents and how they work and the advantages, the overall advantages, both long-term and short-term, there's an increasing adaptation towards biologicals. In fact, British Columbia, which is of Canada, British Columbia is ranked second in terms of the provinces of having the largest greenhouse space, I think. If I remember correctly, there are about 30 million square feet of greenhouse space.
Wow.
And they're predominantly biological-based now. That doesn't mean to say that they don't use any chemicals. There are some greenhouses that use a limited amount of chemicals, but they're trying to move away from it. And so this is part of what's called an integrated pest management strategy.
So you're saying BC was number two in terms of space, greenhouse space. Do you know which province ranks number one?
Number one is Ontario. Ontario has about 60-plus million square feet.
I think it's
between 60 and 70 million square feet as of 2003, 2004. I would imagine that it would be higher now.
So, and the sorts of things that are being grown in these greenhouses in BC and Ontario, is that primarily food or is it flowers?
They can be generally classified to vegetables and ornamentals. We grow a lot of vegetables like greenhouse cucumber, greenhouse tomatoes, peppers. These are three big crops in terms of the vegetable side.
Mm-hmm.
The ornamentals, we're looking at Gerbera daisies and poinsettias. These are two very large crops.
And do the thrips that you are studying, do they feed on all of these different species, vegetables and ornamentals?
Yes, yes. Thrips are a major worldwide pest in both vegetable and ornamental production systems.
So what does a thrip infestation do to a plant?
I'll just give you a couple of examples. So we imagine our cucumber fruit to be straight, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So there's cucumbers that are not put into the market space, the ones that are curled. Have you ever seen curled cucumbers?
No, I don't think I have.
Because they're not marketable. Consumers don't favor curled cucumbers, and that's a result of thrips feeding. On the poinsettia side, consumers demand unblemished leaves, and so what you see with thrips feeding with a light infestation is you see silvering. Basically, it looks like blemishes on a leaf. So when consumers go to any grocery store, they're looking for perfect fruit, perfect vegetables that are blemish-free. And thrips cause damage both directly and indirectly. And what I mean by that is directly by feeding damage and reproductive damage. So when they lay their eggs into the fruit, that leaves a blemish. And when they feed, that also leaves a blemish. And indirectly, they cause damage by transmitting plant viruses.
So they sort of serve as a vector for plant viruses, transferring them from plant to plant within the greenhouse.
Yes. So then when growers see thrip infestations, they want to control it as quickly as possible.
Right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, no problem. It's absolutely my pleasure. I love to share this work.
You're listening to Terra Informa, a syndicated environmental news program produced at CJSR in Edmonton, Alberta. Stay tuned to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
Thanks, Rebecca. This is Terra Informa, environmental news heard nationally. And we're always looking for tip-offs. Got a story, a lead, a scoop? We'll get it out there. Just hit us up with an email at terra@cjsr.com. We'd love to hear from you. Next up, Alex Hindle puts the documentary Gasland in the hot seat for a green screen movie review. Gasland was released last year by young American director Josh Fox. Gasland explores the controversial process of natural gas extraction known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, and its legacy across America thus far. This review is a repeat from earlier in the year, but we liked it so much, we thought we'd bring it to you once more.
Okay, so by now you know what fracking is. Until 2 days ago, I really didn't. I'd heard the term, but I really didn't know what it meant. And I was pretty sure I didn't really want to. Fracking. It sounds almost as bad as it actually is. To bring me up to speed, Terran Formas, Steve and Rebecca sat me down and played Gasland, a 2009 documentary film by the youthful, bespectacled, banjo-playing director Josh Fox. As we found out early in the film, Gasland refers to the enormous swath of the United States, and increasingly Canada, that is home to a new type of natural gas extraction, known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. Fox tells us that at the moment, 34 states are home to fracking, and the film takes a broad sweep across the country, visiting people whose lives have been affected. Indeed, Fox's motivation for the film bubbled up when his land in Pennsylvania caught the attention of the gas companies. But rather than accepting the 100 grand signing bonus that would have brought fracking to his 20 acres, Fox headed out and made a documentary. This direct connection between the director and the issue at hand gives the film a feeling of legitimacy and is evident in Fox's emotional reactions to much of what he sees throughout the film. Groundwater contamination is the common denominator of discontent seen in communities all across the states, and the loss of safe water and the resulting anxiety hangs heavily on the families Fox interviews. Fracking manages to inject enormous volumes of mysterious yet certainly toxic chemicals deep into the ground, while at the same time destabilizing the geological formations that usually sequester and protect groundwater. These two things, that common sense would suggest are a recipe for disaster, have the uncanny effect of mixing chemicals into the aquifers, often rendering them undrinkable.
The results read sort of like the back of a pamphlet that you don't want to pick up at the American Cancer Society. Benzene, dimethyl disulfide, methyl ethyl disulfide, ethyl methyl ethyl disulfide, trimethyl benzene, diethyl benzene, methyl methyl ethyl benzene, tetra methyl benzene, naphthalene.
And if the risk of being poisoned wasn't that enough, many people have had the novel yet distressing experience of seeing their household faucets violently burst into flame. Over and over, we get to see flames shooting devilishly from people's kitchen taps. Add to that, chemical fogs, exploding gas wells, a lack of regulation, the encroachment of fracking on public lands, including the unfiltered watersheds for New York City, balding cats and livestock, and a dash of Dick Cheney, and you start to get a sense of how incredibly toxic the whole fracking situation is. Gasland is most effective as an experiential tour of the fractured lives of rural landowners. The voice of industry is largely absent, but not for Fox's lack of trying. He makes a special point of showing his efforts to interview industry, all of which were declined.
Thank you, Cabot Oil and Gas.
We leave a name and I will return the call.
After the tone, please record your message.
Who is the audience for this?
General public.
I think we'll decline, but thanks for calling.
We do get some insight into the industry's position, however, at a Congressional Subcommittee on Energy and Minerals meeting. There, industry reps do their best to obfuscate, grudgingly offering woefully dissatisfying answers when questioned.
Looking at all these other examples in all these states, there has not been a problem with hydraulic fracturing. And I'm proud that I'm supported by the oil and gas industry because they employ a lot of people in my state, and I'm going to stick up for them. And I'm tired of people trying to shut down an industry when they're not educated on the facts. And if you weren't able to do this hydraulic fracturing, how much more would we be dependent on foreign oil and terrorism?
Like most documentaries on environmental issues, Gasland isn't likely to leave you chipper and optimistic, but it is stylish, informative, and well-presented by a likable and earnest director whose low, raspy voice sucks you in and convinces you to question just how clean natural gas really is.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alex. By the way, if you want more details on any of our stories, or the news headlines we bring you, or you just want to hear the show again, check out our website, terrainforma.ca.
Hurry up, everyone. Get in the car. It's a long way to Kitimat.
All right.
Shotgun.
Coming.
Right, so which one of you tree-hugging vegan hippies can actually drive?
I can ride a bike.
These IDs are good for driving.
Useless bunch of stoners. I'll do the driving then.
Thanks, Uncle Alex.
Woohoo! We've rounded up an award-winning team of crack Terra Informa journalists, and we're taking them 3,000 kilometers across Western Canada. We're following the route of one of Canada's most controversial environmental projects in decades, the multi-billion dollar Northern Gateway Pipeline.
We're speaking to people all along the way. We're talking oil, wilderness, jobs, politics, and money. Join us to find out why people are calling this project the environmental controversy of a lifetime.
And we want you to join us on our radio adventure.
Yeah! Woohoo! We'll be broadcasting in-depth reports from Northern British Columbia in August and September. So tune in this time each week on your local community radio station.
Alex! GPS says go left!
Stop poking me!
On the road again with Terra Informa.
Indeed, the Northern Gateway Pipeline story just keeps on getting bigger. We're looking forward to bringing you our own full documentary. But our work on that issue couldn't have happened without the support of APIRG. That's the Alberta Public Interest Research Group. Thanks, APIRG. Finally now, I've got a piece to share with you. It's on a particularly pernicious family of chemicals called dioxins and a poisoned president.
Diversity.
Automated metering infrastructure.
Natural energies.
Regulate CO2.
PM control strategies.
Natural resource exploitation.
Steady state.
The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
Uranium.
The Enhanced Oil Recovery.
Sustainable energy.
Eco-babble. In 2004, Ukrainian presidential candidate Viktor Yushchenko became suddenly ill whilst on the campaign trail. He was rushed to hospital, but doctors were at a loss to explain his symptoms. Severe abdominal pain, lesions to the face and body, swollen organs and internal ulcers. His political opponents mocked his predicament. Too much cognac, or bad sushi, they suggested. It wasn't until specialists from the UK, France and the US analysed his blood samples that the true diagnosis was confirmed. Poisoning by an obscure and deadly chemical, a type of dioxin known as TCDD. Who exactly attempted to murder the presidential candidate is unknown. At any rate, he survived, just, and went on to become president a year later. But today we're more interested in this class of chemical itself, dioxins, where they come from, what they do, and how to avoid them. These chemicals, dioxins, really are very toxic. The World Health Organization sets its tolerable daily intake at a range of 1 to 4 picograms per kilogram of body weight per day. Given that a picogram is 1/1,000,000,000 of a gram, that's not very much. These chemicals are a class of environmental toxins called persistent organic pollutants. They also have the dubious honour of being known as one of the Dirty Dozen, a group of highly dangerous chemicals that are the focus of UN efforts to reduce by new international treaties. Persistent organic pollutants, such as dioxins, can last in living organisms for years and decades, sometimes accumulating near the top of food chains. They are highly toxic, causing damage to the immune system and the reproductive system, and can cause cancer. Dioxins are created during combustion. They can be produced naturally in forest fires and volcanoes. However, more problematic tends to be artificial sources of these chemicals. Dioxins are not created deliberately. They are a byproduct of industrial processes, such as paper bleaching, metal smelting, herbicide and pesticide manufacturing, and incinerating. Incomplete incineration of garbage and hospital waste is a common source of these toxins. When created by incinerators, dioxins can simply be blown out the chimney. Another common source is improperly disposed of industrial waste. Pesticide and herbicide dumps, for instance, can leak dioxins into soil and waterways. Once released, dioxins can be absorbed into the fatty tissue of animals, which may eventually be eaten by humans. Shellfish living in contaminated areas are known for their accumulation of dioxins. However, most food health scares are the result of contamination from agricultural chemicals. Contaminated livestock feed led to recalls of pork in Ireland 3 years ago. Chicken, eggs, and shellfish were contaminated in 1999 in the USA when an ingredient in animal feed pellets, bentonite clay, was used from a contaminated mine. Some batches of Agent Orange, the defoliant used extensively during the Vietnam War, was also found later to contain dioxins. Studies are ongoing as to the effect of dioxins in Vietnam. Luckily, the emissions of these chemicals can be avoided nowadays, and increasingly are avoided, thanks to regulations and monitoring. Technology is available that prevents the creation of dioxins in incinerators by ensuring that combustion temperatures